From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Unless you grew up in an extremely isolated and rural area, you were probably raised in a food environment where you experienced more than one culture and more than one history. We all grew up in homes where the food that was personal to our families comprised most of what we ate, shaping our palates and memories. But the minute we step outside that bubble, there's another world, the food of our neighbors and friends, and the food sold in storefronts where we live. And that might have completely different roots and references. Yet all those tastes become a part of our memory banks. In his first cookbook, My America, Chef Kwame Onwuachi describes his culinary vantage point. Hi, Kwame.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. This book is so interesting. Can you describe your America that you say is devoid of hot dogs and apple pie?
Yeah, well, my America, you know, was definitely a reflection of my culture, my heritage, and just the surrounding that I was in. You know, I grew up in the Bronx, New York. It was a melting pot of so many different cuisines, you know, from West African to Caribbean to even Southern cuisine. There were so many different aspects of what made my American food different. And that's what I wanted to bring to the forefront with this cookbook, that we're such a melting pot as Americans in general. And, you know, the food is reflected in that.
Can you tell us what was coming out of the kitchens of Jewel and Cassie, your mom and grandma?
Oh, man. Delicious things were coming out of the kitchen. To be specific, there was like shrimp etouffee, there was gumbo, there was oxtail, curry goat, jollof rice, egusi soup, all these different representations of different cultures that make me who I am. But also, you know, there were things that we ate outside of there, like Puerto Rican food and Dominican food. So I wanted to showcase all of that with this book.
You say that food is how you make sense of the world. How did your time in Nigeria inform your cooking? Did it change the way you viewed the food you had grown up eating?
It absolutely changed the way that I viewed food growing up, because we had to like raise our own livestock. You know, we had to procure our own vegetables. So it gave me a deeper understanding of what it takes to even produce something. You know, if we wanted a 10-piece chicken wing bucket, we had to raise 5 chickens, and that took 5 months. So it wasn't as easy as just going and getting something like it is in America. I think that shaped the way that I view food in my profession as well.
You had this really interesting experience in Nigeria more recently on Victoria Island, where you made your food with its both African and diasporic roots for African diners. Can you share a bit of that experience and what you realized?
Yeah, it was beautiful to go back as an adult. I spent my time there from 10 to 12. And that was my first true injection into the culture. But going back as an adult, I was able to travel on the roads that I traveled when I was a kid and really get inspiration. I was cooking a dinner at this restaurant for like what I wanted to cook at the dinner. And what I wanted to cook was I wanted to pay homage to my time there as a child and recreate some dishes that I had eaten, you know, way back when, but the way that I view things through my culinary lens.
And the audience, the diners that were there had really interesting responses to what you served.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they've never seen it done in that way. So it was exciting for them and interesting to see them, their culture reflected on a plate in ways that they haven't seen before.
Could you describe Sula and the Yaji spice?
So Suya is the dish and Yaji is the spice used to make the dish. It's like the grandfather of barbecue. It's thinly sliced meat seasoned heavily with this spice blend that has ginger and garlic and onion and peanut powder and grains of paradise and chilies. It's just grilled over an open flame. And then it's served with chopped onions and tomatoes. It's always around and you can smell it creeping around the corners of the markets in Lagos.
So Kwame, could you read a little piece that starts on the bottom of page 65, please?
Yeah, of course. A skewer is not simply a skewer. meat is not just meat. Food is not just the proteins and fats that form it. It is a continuation of culture, the expression of a society, an embodiment of the tastes and customs of a people. In this hot, dark night, that is what I was savoring. Suya, at home.
So great. I just love the writing in this book. So most of us who cook know that a lot of labor that happens, particularly in the diasporic kitchen, can be hidden, like hours of hidden labor. Can you talk about the significance of the pantry and that hidden labor?
All these dishes have lots of layers of flavor, and the pantry is one of the most important things because we take vegetables and turn them into paste. We take things and pickle them. We build spices, and we use that to start our dishes. So the pantry is really, really important to get a head start on these things, or else it would take you a long time if you don't have anything built up in that pantry.
Can you explain how cayenne and Tabasco are both rooted in slavery and how jerk is a dish of survival?
Jerk came from, it's a dish of freedom. Enslaved people there escaped and were fleeing slavery, and they didn't want to give up their location. So when they did hunt and cook, they would use the ingredients that were around. So like the wild thyme, the wild allspice, there's Thai chilies that grew wild there. And they would rub those into the meat to help preserve it. And then when they cooked it, you know, they would dig a hole, put these meats in the hole, and then cover it with the embers, and then cover that so then the smoke wouldn't reveal where their location was. And that's how jerk came along.
Can you describe dullet and your vegetarian riff on it?
Yeah. So dullet is an Ethiopian dish of organ meat, finely chopped and seasoned with Ethiopian spices. I wanted to make a vegetarian version of that, so I did it with mushroom and added those same spices to it. And then we've topped it with some roasted mushrooms, some pickled mushrooms, and some mesemin bread that you can swipe through to eat it all at once.
There's a beautiful photographic how-to of making moi moi. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what it is and kind of walk us through it?
Yeah, so, you know, moi moi is it's pretty much like a black IP custard. It's almost in the form of like a tamale. So you take the black eyed peas and you have to peel them. So you'll use your blender to break them up in a lot of water. The skins will come to the top, puree it with some tomatoes, some peppers, some palm oil, some ginger, garlic, and then some bouillon cube, some chilies. And you'll set that in banana leaves and steam it. So you'll puree that together, then place it in a banana leaf and steam it. We eat these during festivals. We eat them during celebrations. It's a snack. It can be paired with mackerel. Sometimes people put a whole egg inside of it, a boiled egg. It's like our version of a tamale.
It looks gorgeous. So do you have a show-stopping seafood dish?
I think I have a couple of show-stopping seafood dishes. My mom dukes shrimp, based off of a dish that my mom would make for parties, just like shrimp sautéed in like garlic and butter, and then this house spice that she makes. But then we add a slew of aromatics to that and let that cook down into a paste with shrimp stock. And then we cook the shrimp in that and mount it with butter and serve it with toasted bread and steamed rice. So that's one of my favorite dishes.
So fried chicken. What's special about yours?
I think just the, you know, the seasoning that I put in it, the brine, the flour. I think fried chicken is just a special thing. You don't need to like reinvent the wheel with it, right? This is a classic fried chicken recipe, and learning how to make it the true proper way.
Thank you so much, Kwame.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.
That was Kwame Onwuachi, James Beard Award-winning chef and author. He was named by the San Francisco Chronicle as the most important chef in America. His memoir, Notes from a Young Black Chef, is being adapted for the screen, and we've been discussing his first cookbook, My America. Coming up, vendors at a popular street food corridor struggle after being displaced by yet another sweep.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. For more than 20 years, if you wanted Salvadoran street food in Los Angeles, you went to Vermont Avenue between 11th and 12th Streets. There, you'd find a wealth of vendors serving pupusas, mariscos, tacos, produce, and all kinds of trinkets. But in early May, sanitation officials came in and shut down the area's street vendors. It's not the first time they've cracked down, and this isn't the only neighborhood where it's happened. MacArthur Park, Lincoln Heights, downtown LA, where wherever street vendors pop up, enforcement officials eventually follow. Jeanette Villafana is a journalist and correspondent for LA Taco. She's been covering street food for a while, and she's here to discuss this newest skirmish and the ongoing battle between street vendors and government officials. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Why don't you start by telling us what happened with this latest sweep and when it all went down?
This sweep of the Salvador corridor happened a few weeks ago on a Sunday. Well, it originally happened on a Monday, but vendors began moving from the area as of Sunday that week. This happened because, you know, there was flyers posted around the neighborhood that said a beautification project was on its way and fences were going to be going up. They were warned that they had up until Sunday to move, and anybody who did set up the day of on Monday, they would risk having their stuff confiscated or possibly getting ticketed. But they were completely shocked. They're not back at their original location. A few have moved down the block. Some are renting a space inside of the parking lot, so inside of the fences that are still up. Unfortunately, though, that has caused, you know, people to take advantage of vendor situations, and vendors inside of the parking lot are being charged around $1,500 for like a 10 by 10 space for them to sell.
Is that a month, a day?
A month, yeah. $1,500 a month.
And this particular area along Vermont Avenue has become somewhat famous for its food. Can you kind of paint a picture of what it was like for us?
Yeah, it was lively, I can say that. You know, you just see all these colorful umbrellas. The smell of pupusas is in the air. People are saying hello. They're wanting you to try their food, giving you samples. Even now when I went, the vendors that moved down the block, you get the same vibe, but it's just not the same because they're not all together. And it was community. I can describe it as community. Any of these markets, when you go to them, there's a sense of community. In this case, particularly because the majority of them are Salvadoran or from El Salvador, they have built community amongst themselves as well in the community that they serve.
How many vendors were impacted?
A little over 50 vendors. And like I said, a handful of them moved down the block. Some are renting inside the space. They're renting it from the person who owns the parking lot. They did relocate some to a new area on New Hampshire Avenue, where they're renting a parking lot for some vendors. And this is part of SALEF, which is the organization that is helping these vendors relocate. And the money is supposedly coming from Cedillo, who is helping fund the relocation.
Yeah, that's Gil Cedillo, the LA City Council member of that area.
Correct. But, you know, the removal was shocking because when the words beautification project are put in any type of flyer or are spoken, for residents, it may be like, well, that's great. You know, they're going to come and clean. But for vendors and vendor communities and markets like these, those words are like an alert. An alarm goes off in their head because that means that that could potentially be used to remove them permanently, not temporarily, which we've seen happen before.
So what is this beautification plan?
So the reason why the shutdown happened was because concerns were brought up of sanitation issues by residents and businesses in the area. Whenever this happens and I speak with vendors, they all say similar things. things like, you know, they understand that when it comes to vendor markets, sometimes it can get a little bit of out of hand. They try and maintain everything clean and safe, accessible and walkable for everybody. But, you know, there's also customers who may not throw the trash where they're supposed to. And what they say is they're never against the city. They're never against officials. But what they do want is to be included in these conversations when these beautification projects happen or when any type of project happens that may remove them. In this case, they're power washing the streets. There may be some trees planted a few months back. They also closed it to plant trees, and it took over 3 months for them to get back.
This saga of street vendors being able to vend without complications has been going on for years. I understand that many of these particular street vendors in the Vermont corridor, as elsewhere, aren't licensed. They're selling illegally. Is Cedillo's office working to get them legalized within the system?
According to their press release, they're working with these organizations like Salif to be able to get these vendors licensed. The only problem with that is getting a food license from the health department is almost impossible for a vendor who sells food. You know, this is trying to be changed right now as we speak. Vendors are advocating for the passage of SB 972, which will help modernize this food code that all health departments in California follow.
I've never heard before of a council member stepping in to help vendors who are being removed or relocated. Is this unusual?
It is. Council member Gil Cedillo, the vendors are hoping, you know, that him saying that he's going to help does happen. Like I said, they relocated a handful of vendors, but also, for example, Avenue 26 was closed down, and till this day, they have not returned to the area. Maybe one or two or a handful of them have, but the majority of them have to relocate to a completely different area and start different markets because they were promised a relocation that never happened. So thankfully, in this situation, it seems that Cedillo is working with the organization to help fund this new location that is temporary. It's not permanent.
Can you tell us once again the name of the organization that's helping and tell us what the letters mean?
Yeah. So it's SALEF, and it stands for the Salvadoran American Leadership and Education Fund. They've been working with the Salvador Corridor and vendors, people in that community, for years. So this isn't like something new that they just started doing.
I know that vendors have organized to push for a bunch of reforms, affordable permits, realistic cart designs, and an end to harsh enforcement. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of when those things might actually be coming?
Oh my goodness, I hope soon. But right now, one of the things that's really being pushed by vendors is SB 972, which again, it'll modernize the food code and would literally allow so many vendors, food vendors in particularly, to be able to sell without the fear of being ticketed or having their things taken away because they don't have this golden ticket permit. So hopefully, I want to say within a year maybe. If not, I think vendors are also looking to see what is LA going to do to help vendors. If they can't change the state law, what can LA do to be able to make this pathway a little bit easier?
Well, thank you so much, Jeanette.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's really important to shine light on, you know, these types of stories.
After all, it's what makes LA, LA.
Exactly. Good food, good people.
That was journalist Jeanette Villafana. For a link to her LA Taco story, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. If you've never tried the Palabok Fiesta from Jollibee, or if you've never tried Jollibee at all, you're missing out. A few years ago, the Filipino fast food chain announced plans for a major expansion in the United States. That includes a newly opened outpost in downtown Los Angeles, one of only a handful of Jollibee locations in greater LA. We figured it was the perfect time to visit Jollibee, sample its fare and explore its mystique, and who better to do that with than longtime friend of good food, Karen Tongson. Officially, she's a professor of English, gender and sexuality studies at USC. Semi-officially, she's a hardcore foodie with a palate shaped as much by her youth in Riverside as her Filipino roots. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Evan. So glad to be here on this lovely afternoon with the whole Jollibee spread before us.
Yes, I should say we're at my house and we have brought in a Jollibee feast, which I'm really happy to get to talk to you, but I really want to eat too.
Yeah, let's get down to it. I think that the Jollibee terminology would be to call all of this a fiesta, because that's a kind of branding term for all of these combo meals. So let's have some bites of food.
A fiesta joy.
Fiesta joy. So let's have some fiesta joy now.
I'm going to start with a drumstick.
That crunch happened without the gravy dip. I think that's essential to know, because in front of us, we have, you know, your typical fried chicken bucket with thighs and drumsticks. But you also get these giant vats of gravy to dip them in.
So is the gravy also to pour over rice?
You can dip the chicken in the gravy or pour it over rice. I often will save some of the gravy and just freeze it and cook all sorts of stuff with it later on.
I love that. So can you describe a signature Jollibee flavor profile?
It's mostly savory. I like Jollibee's fried chicken because it is that kind of lightly battered, crispy, crunchy, and not super heavily seasoned other than with the things you want, salt, pepper, etc.
With a tinge of sweetness.
With a tinge of sweetness. I'd say that the other flavor profile that you'll get is sweet. And that's not just in the desserts, but in some of the savory dishes as well.
Most notably, the spaghetti joy. It's this really interesting combination of a slightly sweet tomato sauce with hot dogs and cheddar cheese.
For anyone who's expecting some kind of beautiful ragu, this is a very different kind of spaghetti. I see it as existing in the family of things like bootknocker soup from South Korea. It's stuff like hot dogs, processed things that get put into a pasta, whatever was around from the U.S. military for a particular period of time, and repurposed into a tomato sauce. Because tomatoes aren't as accessible in the tropics, especially in the Philippines, what you have is the use of often actually ketchup or these other products to create these pasta sauces. But the flavor profile, because the spaghetti was made with what was available, it isn't Jollibee's alone. It is a kind of spaghetti that people have made in the Philippines for a very long time, since World War II.
What I love about this spaghetti is that it sort of immediately sets out Jollibee as a place for those of Filipino descent, those in the diaspora, to be at home.
Exactly. And I do want to say that fried chicken and spaghetti is a common combo. If you're having a big family party, you're going to have a big catering tray of spaghetti as well as fried chicken. What Jollibee is doing is they are, as you're saying, reproducing what it feels like to really go to a Filipino fiesta.
And we also have the palabok fiesta. So describe what that is.
So palabok is a type of rice noodle, a noodle dish that is eaten throughout the day. You can have it for breakfast to fill you up, or you can have it for merienda, which is like your kind of afternoon meal between lunch and dinner, or a little snack. And it's rice noodles with a shrimp-based sauce, garnished with crushed chicharron, shrimp, oftentimes some kind of ground meat, and sliced boiled egg. This is the kind of thing that I remember getting as a kid for lunch at school. We have here with us these little plastic packets, not of ketchup, but of lemon juice. And the way one usually serves, let's say, a fancier tray of this is with cut up calamansi citrus, and you squeeze citrus over it to kind of cut some of that funk and to add a brightness to it.
Let's talk a little bit about the business of Jollibee. When and where did the chain get started?
The chain started in Quezon City in 1978, and it was started by someone who is actually ethnically Chinese, who immigrated to the Philippines from southeastern China, Tony Tan Katkyong. The sort of apocryphal story is that these were ice cream shops, and the patrons wanted some savory foods. One of the things that I wanted to clarify about this story, though, is that it wasn't just, you know, a kind of mom-and-pop ice cream shop. It was a franchise of Magnolia Ice Cream, which is a huge ice cream brand. It's like Baskin-Robbins. And so he already was a franchisee. And one of his enhancements to his Magnolia Ice Cream shop was to start adding savory food.
So when did Jollibee come to the U.S.?
I think it was in 1998. And I remember when this happened because I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time. And its first shop was where my grandfather used to live in Daly City. There was tremendous excitement. And there's a huge Filipino community in Daly City, obviously, in south of San Francisco. And I was super excited about that. Even though it serves a different function for me here than it did when I was a little kid having Jollibee. When I was a little kid, we would go and have burgers. And it wasn't until I moved here that I took interest in the other parts of the menu, because it was just like a regular fast food joint when we were in the Philippines.
Interesting. So how many Jollibee locations are here in Southern California?
There are about 10 of them.
Which is not much.
It's not a lot, considering. But it does feel like Jollibee's presence is much larger than the actual number of stores. So, you know, here it becomes this point of nostalgia, a connection to home, whereas there it was a point of connection to here.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So they're expanding.
They've not only bought Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, but also Tim Ho Wan, which is a dim sum brand that used to only be, I think, in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and now it's in Orange County.
Do you have any idea of where in the states they have set their sights?
I know that there's one in New York that recently opened. I believe New Jersey, a lot of Filipinos in New Jersey. Also, you know, globally. The thing is, there are Filipinos all over the world. We're sent out to work all over the place. The Jollibee opening in London was a big deal. People slept in line to be there.
Today, we got the
banana langka. My mouth is full of chicken, so I was asked to. It's banana langka, which we'll see what the situation with that is. The classic is peach mango.
They're so good. The last time I had one of these, it was just like so delicious. So I'm going to try the peach. You try the banana.
So this is a banana langka, which is banana and jackfruit. It's not as banana forward. It's more just kind of like ambiguously sweet.
Given that Jollibee has also bought Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, a brand that's been struggling against coffee behemoth Starbucks, do you think we'll ever see a whipped, frozen, caffeinated Holo Holo?
We might. I think that Jollibee could benefit by thinking about what certain Korean coffee shops have done to create specialty beverages or drinks, or thinking a little bit about how boba tea shops have blown up. If Jollibee does something to Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf that tweaks it so that it captures that little bit of extra instead of just another coffee place, then I think they'll have a winning formula.
I think you have just put yourself on the market as a consultant.
Please, please, let me consult.
This has been such a great way to spend a good part of today. Thank you so much, Karen.
I really had a delightful time. Thanks for inviting me over for lunch.
That was Professor Karen Tongson sharing her love of Jollibee's palabok and fried chicken with all of us. In a minute, shortages of food, fuel, medicine, and toilet paper have led to a terrible economic crisis and widespread riots in Sri Lanka. What does that mean for the country's spice trade? That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. With a $3,000 tax return, Sanaa Javeri Qadri started Diaspora Company, hoping to create an equitable solution to the spice trade. 5 years later, she's continuing her activism by donating a portion of sales from some spices to aid Sri Lanka, a country of 22 million people that is currently experiencing an ongoing economic and political crisis. Hi, Sanaa.
Hi, it's so exciting to be here.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you. I feel like every day I see you in the form of all these beautiful little jars of spices.
Being in people like you's kitchen is sort of what makes me most proud.
It's really fantastic. You've said in the past that you firmly believe that you cannot profit off or consume a culture without showing up for the real human beings upholding that culture. Can you go more deeply into that, please, and how it shapes Diaspora's business practices?
Yeah, I mean, I started this company because I'm an Indian woman whose identity as a post-colonial Indian woman, as somebody who has been affected by the colonial spice trade, it was important to me to build a spice company that rooted my ancestors, my culture, really Indian stories, and how Indian culture uses spices. So I think when we started looking into sourcing from Sri Lanka in particular, I was very aware that I'm not Sri Lankan. I'm from Sri Lanka's kind of big bad neighbor. And if we were going to source from here, how are we going to do it ethically? How are we going to do it in a way that centered Sri Lankan voices? I think that that's often been challenging. Like when we're sourcing from parts of India, me and my team have so much cultural context and so much understanding of who does something profit versus harm. And I think in going into working with Sri Lanka, I had to really acknowledge that when it came to conflict between the Sinhalese and the Tamil community, I had a lot of learning to do. We had a lot of learning to kind of pass on to our community. So it's really been a growing process of if we're going to support these amazing farm partners in Sri Lanka and work with them, how do we tell their stories as equitable translators rather than just kind of project what we think about them into the world in marketing copy?
What spices are grown in Sri Lanka?
Yes, yeah, so the big spice for us is Sri Lankan cinnamon. There's nothing like it in the world. It's considered the indigenous home of cinnamon. Most of the cinnamon that you see in the United States is actually cassia, which grows in China and Vietnam. And then the other spice that grows just incredibly are cloves. In the rest of the world, you can get small cloves that have a relatively high oil content. In the world of spices, oil or fat equals flavor. The more oil content in a spice, the more flavorful. And so the cloves that grow pretty much wild all over Sri Lanka are just bursting with oil, super fat, super rich. Those are the two spices we know them best for, but all kinds of herbs, pandan, curry leaves, turmeric, the gamut.
Can you describe how the Sri Lankan cinnamon tastes compared to the cassia many of us are used to?
I would describe cassia as like candy in that it's spicy, it's hot, it can burn your tongue a little bit, but it's also delicious. Ceylon cinnamon is sort of its delicate, subtle cousin. It has floral notes, it has orange blossom notes. It's really gentle, but it's also very sweet. And we were actually able to identify a variety that was more miris. Miris means chili. And then a variety that was more pani, pani being honey, that was sweeter. And so our cinnamon powder is actually a blend of two true cinnamon varieties that are spicy and sweet, trying to kind of get the best of both worlds. But compared to cassia, it's still very floral, little fruitiness. Yeah, it's gentle.
It's interesting that you're calling it Ceylon cinnamon.
Yeah, and that I'm using the colonial name.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, that's language that personally within the company we've worked away from because Ceylon is the colonial name for Sri Lanka. But within the country of Sri Lanka, the people are very happy using that term, both for tea and for cinnamon. And I think that that has a lot to do with economically the brand that was built around Ceylon cinnamon during British and Dutch colonialism was so strong that for the people of Sri Lanka, the like commercial benefits of that name far outweigh the sort of colonial history.
So tell us a bit about Sri Lanka. Where in Southeast Asia is it? What's the population?
So Sri Lanka is a small island south of India. The tip of southern India and Sri Lanka are very closely connected to each other. The two countries have a long relationship, but Sri Lanka over the past decade or so has been one of those stories of hope of a country that post-Civil War was really growing in terms of its economy, in terms of its tourism sector. I believe it's a population of about 22 million. It's a beautiful country.
So if you could please describe the current economic situation in Sri Lanka and the ongoing political crisis.
Sri Lanka is going through an incredibly difficult time. It's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel, given current events that I can get into. But what's also really exciting is that the people are really coming together right now. So to backtrack a little bit, there's a family in power, the Rajapaksa family, and they have been a long political family. And the feeling amongst the people, and this is sort of what I have learned from people on the ground, is that in this most recent 30-month run of the Rajapaksa family, they have just bankrupted the country to the point where the country is in default on all of its IMF loans, and the country is basically only holding 3 days' worth of cash to operate and relying on tremendous loans from India, from China, even from Bangladesh, really from anybody that'll loan them money in order to survive. Power cuts are peaking at about 13 hours a day, and about 500,000 people, so 500,000 people, have fallen far, far below the poverty line to the point where there's a real crisis of availability of food, medicine, access to basic supplies.
So how has Sri Lanka's current situation impacted the country's spice trade?
It's actually, the spice trade has kept a lot of our partners afloat because the spice trade in Sri Lanka is primarily an export market. And what Sri Lanka most needs right now is foreign currency. The effect of that like cannot be overstated enough. It's enough to make sure that farm working communities can buy fuel so that they can cook or so that they can buy fuel so that they can get to work. So for us, our work has become, how do we promote the continued and growing import of cinnamon and cloves as much as possible so that we can keep funneling dollars any which way we can into Sri Lanka.
You're donating a portion of your sales to the effort. What spices did you choose?
We're going to donate 20% of all proceeds, so from total revenue of sales of the Sri Lankan cinnamon powder, then the quills, the cinnamon quills that are a new spice for us and really exciting, and also the candy and cloves. So we're basically saying that if we're in any way profiting off of selling products off of Sri Lanka, now is the time to pass that profit back to the people of Sri Lanka. And we've partnered with a nonprofit called Sarvodaya, and their mission right now is to feed and create 10,000 family food packs and set up 100 community kitchens. Collectively with a couple other companies, raised about $15,000, but we're trying to get to $100,000.
Thank you for doing this work and for bringing these issues to our consciousness. You know, it's so interesting. So much of what we eat, we don't see as being part of the farming cycle.
Yeah.
And the work you do to break open that part of trade is so important.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Sanaa Javeri Qadri, CEO and founder of Diaspora Co. To find ways to donate to the food crisis in Sri Lanka, visit sarvodayausa.org. That's sarvodayausa.org. I don't know about you, but my spices don't take up a cupboard. They fill an entire closet. And sometimes I just open it up and inhale, wondering about all the stories contained within these small jars. Eleanor Ford has had a serious spice obsession for years. It led her to research the aromatics and explore how their winding paths changed the world's cuisine. She ended up writing an entire book about it. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi.
You begin your exploration, your book called The Nutmeg Trail, with the question, what unites Indian garam masala, Lebanese seven spice, French quatre épices, Moroccan ras el hanout, and Middle Eastern baharat? What is that that unites them all?
Well, it's the spice nutmeg, which I think is so versatile. It's got so many different flavor notes in it, from the sweet to the bitter to the aromatic. It lifts so many spices and spice blends, and so is used really universally.
Can you describe how it grows and where it comes from?
Well, nutmeg's got a rather extraordinary story. Initially, it only grew in 10 tiny islands, which are in the East Banda Sea of Indonesia. And these really remote islands, it's hard to think that from there it travelled such a great distance for many thousands of years to really be embraced around the world's cuisine. And at one stage it was considered so important, so sought after, that a big exchange was made by two colonial powers for two different islands on the other sides of the world from each other. In 1667, the British and the Dutch traded the island of Roon, this really small tropical island where nutmeg grows. The Dutch got that island, and in return, the British got Manhattan. And so New Amsterdam became New York.
That's extraordinary. I never heard that story.
Well, it really shows something about the regard and esteem that nutmeg and all spices were held. They had such a journey behind them, such a power. They were really used as a status symbol. So whoever controlled spice had a great power in the world.
You talk about how the ancient world where spices were grown was relatively peaceful until colonialism. So can you go a bit deeper into the role that spices played in the development of European land grabbing?
Well, the spice trade dates back 4,000 years, really. And for most of its history, there's been many, many actors and people trading spices, moving them east to west, west to east. And for the large part, it was very peaceful. And it was a way of laying the foundations of globalization, of human exchange. And so things would move along with the spices, ideas and languages, religions and cuisines. It was really later, when we get to about the 15th, 16th century, that spice did have this enormous lure, particularly in Europe, and the value became so huge. And of course, when value gets high, people get hungry for it and want to control it. And so we've got this sort of extraordinary time where Columbus sailed across the Atlantic looking for peppercorns and, of course, arrived at the New World. We had explorers travelling east and west everywhere, all in the search of spice, and a lot of laying these early colonial powers as well. So there's a very bitter and sad tale behind spice.
In fact, you say that cooking with spice can't be neutral.
Well, so many of the colonial powers that were laid down, perhaps even a little bit of slavery, can be traced to these trades. When you have the movement of people away from their homes to work on spice plantations, you have colonial powers taking over, you have Portugal, the UK, the Dutch, the Spanish, all entering in and taking parts of Asia as their own, very often because of the want of control, this commodity, which is essentially what spice was. So spice has got, a heavy weight resting on its shoulders.
I want to talk about black pepper. These days, we do so many deep dives into chilies, and certainly living in Southern California, the cuisines that we eat on a daily basis are laden with chilies. But I'm fascinated by how black pepper became so ubiquitous. Where is the original home, and why did the world fixate on the one type of black pepper we usually see instead of long pepper or cubebs?
Ah, well, interesting question. I think there was a time when all of these peppercorns vied for power. The long pepper from Indonesia, those sort of spiky long catkins, they were much more popular in medieval times than they are now. Cubeb peppers too, with their little curled tips. But somehow it was the black peppercorns from southern India that really caught. Perhaps it was more of a trading power than anything else. People managed to get a good lock on the trade, scale up the industry and bring them west and bring them east. What's interesting to me is that peppercorns have held a big sway in Asian food long before chili arrived. Chili only came to Asia in the 16th century, but there's always been a taste for heat. So before chili, there were black peppercorns, there was ginger, there was mustard seed. And these were these flavours that humans crave, that warmth, that piquancy that pepper can lend. So whilst the spice trade was starting up, was developing, there wasn't chili as an option. So pepper and its other relations really took hold around the world.
There's a recipe in your book for Kerala black pepper chicken. Can you describe it and how the black pepper is layered throughout the dish?
So this Kerala black pepper chicken is exactly one of the dishes I was talking about, which really relies on pepper as a heat before chili had come to the world and had taken over in bringing that warmth. So it uses black peppercorns generously. For four people, it uses 2 tablespoons of black pepper. And when you cook it, it's all about layering those flavours. So to start with, chicken is turned in a marinade of lemon juice, turmeric, salt, and a little bit of black pepper. Then you get a bigger hit where you toast whole peppercorns and fennel seeds in a pan until they become very aromatic and toasty. And those you crush coarsely with a pestle and mortar. And they're added later on in the dish, along with onions, along with garlic and ginger, to form this big, bold depth of flavour.
Your personal spice collection has been characterized as being vast. I love that word. How do you keep it fresh? Are you constantly rotating spices?
Well, yes, I think we so often read about the importance of keeping our spices fresh, and it can be easy to ignore that advice and think it doesn't matter, I'm not going to change them. But really, it does make the single biggest dish difference to your cooking. So for the spices I use most often, I try to buy them in small amounts. I try to store them away from light and heat and in airtight containers so that they're kept as fresh as possible. But then, of course, I am drawn to the unusual and more obscure spices. So I've got all sorts of those. It's harder to turn those over in the same quantity.
I know. I open my closet sometimes and I stand there. I'm like, what do I do? I don't want to. It's like children. I don't want to let any of them go.
And spices you can collect from your travels and that bring back a memory of a place, and you have great visions of using it, but then it might be harder when you're home.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. The book is quite engaging and I love speaking with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Eleanor Ford is a multi-award-winning author writing about food and travel. Her new book, The Nutmeg Trail, Recipes and Stories Along the Ancient Spice Routes, is out now. Up next, a flower that you can use in food comes into bloom. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market, where Ben Mims has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Ben Mims with the Market Report. I'm standing in a beautiful garden on the border of Silver Lake and Frogtown with Horace Cameron, a gardener of what he calls a sometimes urban farm or sometimes market garden. How are you doing, Horace?
I'm doing good.
So we're standing in this beautiful garden. I'm looking around. I'm seeing lots of big plants, some things that are like kind of tied to sticks and staves, neat rows, some things are growing wild. Tell me about this garden and just where we are.
Sure. This garden I started in the late summer of 2020. It was through a friend that had hired me to get a gardens going for him. he got sidetracked. We kind of shelved the project. And then I kind of just propositioned him. I was like, look, you have this big backyard, just dirt, 2,500 square feet. I live in an apartment. I've always kind of done this. And he was like, hell yeah, like, do whatever. So I got to a point where I built the whole thing out and designed it. And then I started having too much produce. I then scrambled to try to find people that would come and buy whatever I had, even though it's not a ton.
How did you get started gardening? Like, where did it first start to lead you up to this point?
Well, I started about sometime over 4 years ago. I had some mental health issues that I wanted to kind of address, and gardening seemed like the natural path to figure some of that out. I started doing rooftop gardening in pots and containers. By the time it got really hot in LA and on the rooftop, it just everything started dying because it was just too much. And then I started kind of guerrilla gardening on the side of my apartment building, and then eventually just started propositioning friends to use their backyard. And it was always like a trade-off. I'll give you a bit of what I grow, and I'm beautifying your space. So, yeah, it was always a great situation.
What was the first thing that you ever planted here?
Well, the first thing that I can remember that I planted was this Satsuma plum that I bought a couple years ago with nowhere to put it. So it was in the container for a while. And I kind of went from there and then just creating the raised beds and planting in ground and kind of figuring it out as I go.
Can you kind of give me a quick rundown of some of the main things that you have planted that have taken really well and that you're really excited about and that are doing well?
You know, I have three figs that are doing really well. The only thing that was here is the peach tree, and I've taken better care of the peach tree, and it's produced a good amount of fruit now. I planted a banana tree, which is really cool, which I'm excited to see how that goes. And I got it on Etsy when it was like 2 inches. It's a blue Java ice cream banana, two persimmon trees. I'm only talking about fruit trees, obviously, but I love growing all the tomatoes here in the summer and peppers and eggplants.
So I know the last time we spoke before, we kind of talked about how you have all these very kind of niche fruit trees that you're growing too, like the medlars and other things like that. Can you tell me a little more about those unusual fruit trees that you're also growing here as well?
I've always been interested in looking for things that I can't find at the farmers markets, like the medlar I got recently, and it was 1 foot tall and it's already putting out 2 fruits. I'd recently just got supposedly the lemon from Italy that they make limoncello with. And then I got another citrus from Italy called Chinotto, which is like a sour orange. The fig, Flanders fig, I've never tried before. I've always looked at seed catalogs or like fruit tree websites or whatever, just being like, I want to know what that tastes like and I don't know where to find it. So I'll just buy the plant or plant the seed.
You're growing this stuff yourself as well, but you've also told me that you've been selling or giving, you know, some produce to actual chefs around the city. Can you tell me who are some of the people that are buying from you and what are they getting?
It's been more private chefs or people who are doing pop-ups because I only can grow so much. And if I have sold some stuff, and I have sold some stuff to like Jelena, 10 pounds of purple peas. It was just a one-off situation. Another friend, Balo, he's my most insistent guy. He comes and he buys fava beans, chicories. He came yesterday and bought some borage flowers and some celery flowers. And he got some rose geranium to make for some kombucha. But he's always like kind of interested and he's just like, yeah, I'll try that. He has an open mind and is willing to take a chance on whatever. So it's a great kind of working relationship, actually.
That was Horace Cameron, gardener of a sometimes urban farm and market garden on the border of Silver Lake and Frogtown. I'm here with Balo Orozco, chef fermenter of Sunset Cultures. Good afternoon, Balo. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you.
So, Bala, we are here in South Central in this kind of mega complex of commercial kitchens. And I see this is where you're making your kombucha. So tell me how you got started making kombucha.
So right after our restaurant closed, Onda, I never really had time to go to visit the farmers, you know, in the farms. I'm like very close. I have a really good relationship with them from just going to a market like every week. And because that's when the pandemic started, we start seeing like literally just everyone was mixing the produce back into the soil or just like cutting everything off and just composting it, everything. Things that like they were working on, like let's say tomatoes, just like you work on for like about three, four months to grow the plant and take care of it, labor, everything. And they were just dumping everything back to the soil. So this was Wukong, Tao's farm. So we were like, dude, like, let's do something. We started preserving this. We started making kombucha actually with strawberry. We were making also preserves like sauerkraut, tomato sauce. We probably made, I think, 16,000 quarts of tomato sauce in about 3 months. It was insane because we didn't really have this space. We were working from like our house and like friends' restaurants, and it was really hard because it was about 15,000 pounds a week of produce that we were getting from the market. We were just giving it back to them, to the farmers, so they can like sell it. So that's how we were making a little bit of money. But that's how we were like, I think we can do this in a bigger scale.
So tell me about how you turn all this, you know, leftover produce from the market into kombucha. What's that process like?
So we decide what we want to do for the next 3 months. Right now we are working with Mori Family Farm. We're going to do a flavor with sherry and fig leaf, because you get like this like coconut green flavor from it, and it's so good and so special. Porous, I'm making something with rose geranium.
What kombucha uses the rose geranium that you get from Horace's backyard garden?
So it's rose geranium and oro blanco. I'm actually just working on it, but it should be out in about a couple of weeks.
So how many rose geranium petals or blossoms does it take to make a batch of kombucha?
Not much, because a little goes a long way. I want to start using more things. Maybe I would like to partner with him in some way that maybe he can grow my marigold for me to make a brew. It takes about 15 days to ferment this. Less than 15 days, but the whole process, 15 days.
What are some other things that kind of Horace is growing in his backyard that you like to go and to get to make for kombucha, or just to cook for yourself, for your own pop-ups and things like that?
I'm making vinegar, persimmon vinegar. I'm making strawberry vinegar.
Thank you so much, Balo.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben.
That was Balo Orozco, chef and fermenter of Sunset Cultures. For The Market Report, this is Ben Mims.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Tyler Boudreau, Ben Mims, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. I love to use cinnamon to make old-fashioned cinnamon toast. Mix cinnamon sugar, toast bread, slather with butter, generously sprinkle cinnamon on top, eat. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.